Thanks for taking the time to be here this morning. So I'm going to be co-presenting some of our data and model development with Dr. Mike Rivito. So we went again for the longest title, I think, so that's always a good thing. But as Al said, you know, this is an important process that we've been working on because in order to have policy, you have to know what you're working with. So we're doing a lot of the work in the areas of understanding what are some barriers, what are some issues that relate to men's health, and how do we actually change that to incorporate it into policy and programs. So that's kind of the genesis of this process. So we do have a couple of things to note. I am the author of a book, full disclosure, and Mike is also the CEO and founder of the Men's Health Initiative Incorporated down in Orlando. So what we hope to cover in this session briefly is understanding what are some of those interpersonal and social barriers that affect men accessing healthcare. You'll see some data and some background information that shows very clearly that men, particularly minority men, do not receive adequate healthcare if they even engage in the system. The second part, of course, I just kind of ahead of myself there, we'll talk about those racial and ethnic differences. And then finally, how do you start incorporating that into the public health discussion that hopefully will translate to policy, that will hopefully translate to quality programming, not just doing things for men. So I'm going to leave off there, and Mike's going to talk a little bit about the background of why we're doing this in the first place.
So if y'all hear me, small secret. Many of us know some of these outcomes, but just to go through them quickly, males die sooner, approximately 7 years earlier than females, and this could vary between different age groups. It was back in the early part of the century, it was a bit smaller gap, like maybe 1 year difference or 2 years differences. Really expanded in the 60s, the disparity in health or mortality, but it closed a little bit, but it's about 7 years on average. Out of the top 10, 15 outcomes, men tend to have worse outcomes, higher mortality rates than women, and morbidity rates than all, not just the U.S., but all the world. That tends to go fly under the radar many, many times. We just are highlighting that a bit more. Males experience lower health-related quality of life scores, depending on the outcome, depending on the situation, but in general, males do have worse quality of life when it comes to health-related outcomes. Men of color and minority populations, they tend to, across all or most outcomes, actually have increased problems, increased issues, they have access problems. So that's one population we could pay more attention to, but it's a general overview. If you want to take a look at it, I'll kind of go to the rate ratios here, just to give you a quick little graphic. Males, except for cerebrovascular disease, have about an inequitable. If you look at the suicide rate, that's 350% increase risk. That's alarming. Compared to the females, that's a 350% increase risk. Chronic liver disease and cirrhosis, that's about 120% increase risk. Homicide, 230% increase risk. If you keep going like up, accidents, 130% increase risk. If you think about what's causing these outcomes, risky behaviors, smoking, there's a bunch of different things. Those are health outcome data, but think about the behaviors that are causing it. We'll kind of go into that a little bit. Also, some of these ratios, the injuries, again, you see, just look on the right over there, that's 2.4. Again, that's 140% increase. Influenza and pneumonia, 50%. So you can see how men have these adverse health outcomes compared to females in a lot of situations. Last one here, just cancer statistics. You can see all of them up. Males, all races on the right, or on the left, females on the right. Look at prostate cancer versus breast cancer. I will not take anything away from the research rate, because it's breast cancer, but look at the prostate cancer. There's a lot more. Well, not a lot more, but there's more. Yeah. If you look, go down the list here, lung and bronchial, colorectal, urinary bladder, you can see that they're higher than male population.
Yeah, so as we build the case for, you know, why we're here and what we do, every year it's the same story. It seems to be the same story. So these are some data from the study, actually from our study, looking at how well people were able to identify some of the things that Mike just went through. Do the populations that we survey actually know what's going on? And actually confirmed here, they are pretty good. They do know men live sicker. They know men have more issues. The areas highlighted in red, however, are areas where they got it a little wrong. They flipped it. They think women had more issues with cancer, and they also thought men had more issues with Alzheimer's, when in fact it's actually the opposite, right? Men experience more cancers, different types, and women actually have more rates of Alzheimer's because women tend to live longer. And we know that's a disease of progression. So going on the issues of ethnic minority men's health, this is a Kaiser study, Kaiser Family Foundation study, that looked at kind of the areas that I'm going to highlight, overall health status and who experienced the worst health status. So in terms of health status, in terms of access and utilization, which is what Mike and I are focusing on, and then the social determinants of health. So if we're looking at health status, American Indian, Native American, tribal affiliations seem to have the worst health outcomes. What we're interested in, access, is the largest growing minority population in the United States, right? So Hispanic, Latino groups. And in the social determinants, it's also Hispanic, Latino. So when we're looking at how policy is informed by a lot of these rates and figures, we have to be very, very mindful of who's collecting the data, where are the data coming from, and more importantly, how do we translate that in a gender-sensitive, culturally appropriate way? So if you are kind of sitting there in this morning letting the coffee set in, you're like, well, so what does all this mean? These are health disparities. These are inequitable approaches for an entire gender, an entire half of our population. So my question is always the same. Why do they tend to kind of fly by? Why, if we see gun violence, do we not talk about gender as a major factor with gun violence? So it could go on and on about that. So we know these, right? We know disparities. You've already seen that. We know what causes fatality, what causes morbidity. We also understand a little bit more about accessing healthcare, and maybe quality healthcare is kind of a harder thing to kind of dissect. But how does that translate to behaviors? Some of the things Mike talked about are modifiable behaviors. So how does that actually translate to policy, legislation, advocacy in the areas of gender-sensitive programming? So a lot of these issues are preventable, as you've seen. But oftentimes men are accessing the healthcare system either by force, they have to, because something becomes so dire that they can't live with it, or they fall into it because of emergencies or illnesses or injury. So how do we actually work with men to prevent it? Addison Mihalik, which I talk quite a bit about in my research because they do a lot of the psychosocial stuff, talk quite a bit about it's stigma. It's losing a sense of your masculinity. We talked a little bit about this last night with masculinities, right? To be narrow-minded and say there's masculinity and that's it is the same way as saying you're all the same people here, right? There's no diversity in your background. So Addison Mihalik talked quite a bit about if we're going to do programming and policy, we really have to look at what actually will bring the level of stigma down depending on what behaviors men are doing. So Mike's going to talk a little bit about some of these cultural things that create the cultural barriers.
Yeah, I'll start here. Jim and I did a piece a couple years ago. It's called Normative Content Theory. We're talking about how men are expected to live sicker and die younger. It's just ingrained in our brain that we're supposed to have these outcomes like this, live sicker and die younger. So we kind of took that on in that it was generally accepted that men live fewer years. Again, they are expected to get sicker way more often. That's not, like, that shouldn't be the case, but we kind of accepted that's not true or just normal. That's one thing, but I just want to highlight that. The cultural and social expectations, daily experiences, like barriers they stack against male being drafted for health. It's not expected for you, for, as a young man, to go ask about testicular health to somebody. But then it's a little bit embarrassing to talk about anything sensitive like that. So that's one barrier. That's just one barrier. There's a lot of them in the social cultural sphere we have here. Weaknesses, femininity, you cannot be feminine if you're a man. If you're a man, that goes against like, what you've been taught as a kid. Stigma, many other challenges, and one mass idea that will be a man, man up. Yeah, it's cheeky and it sells beer right there, right? It does. It sells a lot of different things. But when it comes to the psychosocial health of a young man, you're really a detriment. Again, it sells beer, but it doesn't really sell a lot of different. But again, there's Jim's piece. The biology and the telomere, like I'll let Jim talk on that. That was kind of like a little thing there. That's why I highlighted green and italicized. I'll let him take that on. But we do think, and that's part of our whole MO, we think that it's very, well, it is imperative to understand why males do live sicker and die younger. It's not just as easy as, oh, we're just getting to the clinic. It's way more involved. It's how to talk to a guy, how to get him there. That's what the study really highlighted. How are males accessing health?
And just briefly on the telomere, there are studies that show that men do tend to have shorter telomeres, which basically take away from the ability to regenerate your cells. But again, what are the social determinants that lead to those changes? So yet again, I fall back on social determinants of health, whereas saying, yeah, there's a lot of diversity in biology. It doesn't mean you have to live with that. So thank you for bringing that one up there, Mike.
So again, this study that Jim put the PI on, we're trying to figure out what precludes males, what makes males access healthcare, what prevents them from accessing healthcare. It's not about simplicity. It's really complex, and we'll see Jim's dendritic diagram, which is 40,000 variables. I think it's really interesting stuff. It's really complex. We're trying to deconstruct the social, cultural, psychological determinants that promote better access to healthcare, what prevents them from going to healthcare or getting healthcare. We're trying to devise more targeted and cost-effective preventative programming as enhanced males' overall, again, health-related quality of life. That's something that's not really reported too much about males. What's their overall quality of life? Not just number of years lived, but psychosocially as well. And this theory that we use, again, this is me and Jim, so Jim and I, the director matter. Theory of normative consciousness.
He and me.
Hegemonic masculinity health belief model really informed our approach to this. We're trying to dissect the confluence of our social environment, our cultural environment, psychological determinants. We're trying to get it all into one little complex little model. It's hard, trust me. What works, what doesn't work, we're trying to prevent this from happening. Because that's what's going on right now. So, Jim's study really highlighted that.
So I'm going to focus on phase three. So this is a multiphasic project. Really, the qualitative stuff was really cool, presented that in some other conferences. And we're always trying to resolve whether or not is it gender or is it resource-based. Do men not access healthcare because they're afraid of giving up things like time and money? Or does it have something to do with what Addison Mihalik talked about, this giving away their masculinities, fearing stigma? So the phase three is what we really focused on to try to understand that through model development and testing some of those models. And then I'll talk a little bit later about beyond that. So yeah, this is the very scary, expansive model that was originally generated. It is. But these areas that are highlighted in red are consistent with what Addison Mihalik are talking about in terms of stigma. So this is on the psychobehavioral aspects of why men may not access healthcare. A little hard to see there. You don't have to worry about reading, squinting, and seeing all that. But there's a clear line that lines up to what Addison Mihalik are talking about, which is what men ask themselves before they do things, right? What a lot of men do. I don't want to generalize. You know, some of these questions are, how do others respond if I do this? What if I do make my own appointment? Am I viewed strongly or am I viewed as, you know, oh, you're kind of caving into the pressure from the wife, the girlfriend, the partner? So Addison Mihalik, as you can see, I do rely on them for a lot of this stuff. We're talking about health-seeking gender role norms, right? So these are issues that men and women have to understand is going to present as a daily issue that may or may not promote healthy behavior. Al does a lot of work up in Cambridge with getting men engaged in these healthy behaviors. He could probably speak for days on that. So phase two, just really briefly, they were qualitative. We asked them some basic questions. What are some of your barriers? What are some of your enablers? That's a whole different study. It actually led to a refined model. Actually, the model grew instead of contracted, which is something little didn't expect the model to grow. We expected to pare it down. So that's what it looks like. Again, these are data that will be published hopefully in the next few months. So what we did is a convenience sample from a community sample as well as online forum. We had a scale developed that basically was confirming the model. So we went through pilot testing. We did confirmatory interviews or confirmatory qualitative analyses. Also, we did an exploratory factor analysis to assure that the questions were reasonable. The data analysis was, again, confirmed through the EFA. We did descriptive stats, and we also did a multiple regressions model to look at what the strongest factors are. So phase three, what did we find? A little hard to see here. Our sample was about two-thirds men. We also had a variety of ages, but they were within that kind of middle age, a little younger than middle age. Fairly wealthy, fairly college educated, so that's a huge limitation of this study. We did have a smattering of different racial ethnic minority groups, which was good to see. So here's kind of the heart of what we're here to talk about, and I'll be very brief about this. So regression models talked about, from this part of it, it wasn't masculine. It was something that relies on the stigma. So this goes contrary to a lot of the resource-based discussions that we were having. Men seem to still come back to that, I am fearful of accessing healthcare. I don't want to give away my masculinities. And it seemed to be less dependent on resource, which kind of blew my mind a little bit, because I hear a lot of the discussions, my own friends, my own family, I don't want to give that copay up. You know, that's $35 to go see a specialist. So a lot of these things kind of reinforce that gender role norm that I was talking about. It's not macho, as you can see here. A little bit on the access, right? Hard to get appointments, or maybe my doctor doesn't understand me. I had a Latino man talking about the healthcare that he received in Puerto Rico was superior to when he came here for the doctor. He said it wasn't because I had more stuff here. It was because my doctor actually listened to me in Puerto Rico. And the doctor's here, very smart, probably smarter than my doctor in Puerto Rico, but he kept talking about there are the problems relating to his own ethnicity and his own experiences here. And then we have other parts of the model that do this too. So I'm going to speed through a few of these in efforts of time. Again, the major take home from these data are stigma, masculinity are things we need to weave into these programs. We need to weave those into the policies. I have lots of qualitative data that I can share with you after, maybe in some other conference or somewhere here. But again, when we consider how we integrate these into policy, we have to do it in a gender-sensitive, meaningful way for these men and for their partners and everybody else. So we were able to develop a model, a lot of these issues confirming the use of our normative content theory, as well as hegemonic masculinity and some of the health behavior model attributes were partially supported through the data. So can we develop a robust model? Sure. Do we identify the statistically significant factors? Yes. What are common enablers for men? Again, gender-sensitive programming. I keep saying the same thing, so I'll be brief on that. So I think Mike's going to talk a little bit about the conclusions in our final couple minutes.
Yeah,
and
I believe we've got 2 minutes left.
Yep.
One thing about the complexity of that model, it's a good thing in a way, because it detracts from the simplicity that we all kind of think of what makes a man go to healthcare. If you really equip with those R-squared values, they're 51, it's like 0.51. We're not explaining everything. We're looking at half on some of these issues, like half explaining. There are other things that we have no idea about, which is kind of scary a little bit, and we don't know what we don't know. So those R-squared values are great, but they're not everything. We've got to keep that in mind. There are other variables out there that we're still trying to figure out how complex it is. But just to kind of go through this, we're trying to inform practice, we're trying to inform programming, we're trying to inform advocacy. What can we take to the community members and to these outreach organizations and say, listen, these guys are not going because of these reasons, they're going because of these reasons. You have to use that to inform practice. That's kind of the gist of like what's really going on. But besides that, I mean, Jim can kind of talk about like what types of international programming, we're trying to inform practice. That's the key in all this.
Right, and part of this is for measurable outcomes, right? That's what's going to be the golden goose, to get your funding, to make sure that we actually have monies and staffing to be able to do that. So that's kind of the goal. You know, this needs more testing. We obviously need more diverse, full disclosure, there's 489 respondents now that we have from our original 250 person survey. So we actually have some changes there. You know, other countries seem to do it fairly well. So we are advancing in the United States towards a men's health policy. The Men's Health Network, as well as the Men's Health Caucus, which please join that, have done a lot of work towards that. But Australia, Ireland, you know, this has been decades of working with this. So we really need to kind of model our own public health policy, not model, but kind of make our own unique contributions towards that. And there's a lot of good things happening out there. You know, again, too little time to talk about all the great things there that Mike's doing down in Florida, Steve Petty's doing over in Oklahoma, and a lot of others. So, you know, programming could look very interesting. I won't go into that based on our time here. But think about what's modifiable. You know, we learn based on our early experiences. So I'll leave you with a couple of thoughts here. You know, let's start early. Let's make primary prevention the major goal of what men's health can be and what male health can be. I've been talking about this for years, too. We talk about men's health. It's about male health, and it's about understanding what those factors are that go into shaping male health. And just to end off here, Jeffrey Vickers talked quite a bit about when things become unacceptable in public health, we start saying it's a problem, we're going to do something about it. You heard in yesterday's keynote. So we're on a platform here to say let's do something about it, and primarily through policy. So a lot of great people worked on this project, and we're continuing to work on it. We hope to publish it soon. But thanks to Mike for working with me on this, and thank you all for being here early this morning. Thanks, Al.